Chapter 11. Making Smaller Circles. My search for the essential principles lying at the hearts of and connecting chess, the martial arts, and in a broader sense the learning process, was inspired to a certain extent by Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I'll never forget a scene that would guide my approach to learning for years to come. The protagonist of Persig's story, a brilliant, eccentric man named Phaedrus, is teaching a rhetoric student who is all jammed up when given the assignment to write a 500-word story about her town. She can't write a word. The town seems so small, so incidental. What could possibly be interesting enough to write about? Phaedrus liberates the girl from her writer's block by changing the assignment. He asks her to write about the front of the opera house outside her classroom, on a small street, in a small neighborhood of that same dull town. She should begin with the upper left-hand brick. At first, the student is incredulous, but then a torrent of creativity unleashes, and she can't stop writing. The next day, she comes to class with 20 inspired pages. I believe this little anecdote has the potential to distinguish success from failure in the pursuit of excellence. The theme is depth over breadth. The learning principle is to plunge into the detailed mystery of the micro in order to understand what makes the macro tick. Our obstacle is that we live in an attention deficit culture. We are bombarded with more and more information on television, radio, cell phones, video games, the internet. The constant supply of stimulus has the potential to turn us into addicts, always hungering for something new and prefabricated to keep us entertained. When nothing exciting is going on, we might get bored, distracted, separated from the moment. So we look for new entertainment, surf channels, flip through magazines. If caught in these rhythms, we're like tiny current-bound surface fish, floating along a two-dimensional world without any sense for the gorgeous abyss below. When these societally induced tendencies translate into the learning process, they have devastating effect. Let's return to the martial arts. I think it's safe to say that many people, consciously or unconsciously, associate the term martial art with legend and film. We think of ninjas passing invisibly through the night, or shrouded heroes running up walls and flying through the air in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. We see wild, leaping Van Damme kicks and Jackie Chan flips. We watch completely unrealistic choreography, filmed with sophisticated aerial wires and raucous special effects. And some of us come away wanting to do that stuff too. This leads to the most common error in the learning of martial arts, to take on too much at once. Many kung fu schools fuel this problem by teaching numerous flowery forms, choreographed sets of movement, and students are rated by how many forms they know. Everyone races to learn more and more, but nothing is done deeply. Things look pretty, but they're superficial, without a sound body mechanic or principled foundation. Nothing is learned at a high level, and what results are form collectors, with fancy kicks and twirls that have absolutely no martial value. I had a different approach. From very early on, I felt that the moving meditation of Tai Chi Chuan has the primary martial purpose of allowing practitioners to refine certain fundamental principles. For example, shifting weight by releasing the hip joints, ever-deepening relaxation, the coordination of mind, breath, and body, awareness of internal energies, winding up to deliver a strike, coiling incoming force down into the ground, rooting, emptying one part of the body while energizing another. Many of them can be explored by standing up, taking a stance, and incrementally refining the simplest of movements, for example, pushing your hands 6 inches through the air. With the practice of this type of simplified motion, you can feel the subtlest ripples inside the body. You become aware of all the tension that resides in your feet, legs, back, and shoulders. Then you release the tension, step by step, hour by hour, month by month. And with the fading of tension comes a whole new world of sensation. You learn to direct your awareness inside the body. And soon enough, your fingers come alive with tingling. You feel heat surging up your back and through your arms. The Tai Chi system can be seen as a comprehensive laboratory for internalizing good fundamentals, releasing tension, and cultivating energetic awareness. I practiced the Tai Chi meditative form diligently, many hours a day. At times, I repeated segments of the form over and over, honing certain techniques while refining my body mechanics and deepening my sense of relaxation. I focused on small movements, sometimes spending hours moving my hand out a few inches, then releasing it back, energizing outwards, connecting my feet to my fingertips with less and less obstruction. Practicing in this manner, I was able to sharpen my feeling for Tai Chi. When through painstaking refinement of a small movement, I had the improved feeling. I could translate it onto other parts of the form, and suddenly everything would start flowing at a higher level. The key was to recognize that the principles making one simple technique tick were the same fundamentals that fueled the whole expansive system of Tai Chi Chuan. This method is similar to my early study of chess, where I explored endgame positions of reduced complexity, for example, king and pawn against king, only three pieces on the board, in order to touch high-level principles, such as the power of empty space, zugzwang, where any move of the opponent will destroy his position, tempo, or structural planning. Once I experienced these principles, I could apply them to complex positions because they were in my mental framework. However, if you study complicated chess positions and middle games right off the bat, it's difficult to think in an abstract, axiomatic language because all your energies are preoccupied with not blundering. It would be absurd to try to teach a new figure skater the principle of relaxation on the ice by launching straight into triple axels. She should begin with the fundamentals of gliding along the ice, turning, and skating backwards with deepening relaxation. Then, step by step, more and more complicated maneuvers can be absorbed while she maintains the sense of ease that was initially experienced within the simplest skill set. So, in my Tai Chi work, I savored the nuance of small morsels. The lone form I studied was William Chen's, and I took it on piece by piece, gradually soaking its principles into my skin. Every day I did this subtle work at home, and then tested it in class that night. It was easy to see whether something worked or not, because training with advanced players like Evan usually involved one of us getting smashed onto the wall. In these intense sparring sessions, showy moves didn't work. There was no margin for idealized fanciness. Things happened too quickly. It soon became clear that the next step of my growth would involve making my existing repertoire more potent. It was time to take my new feeling and put it to action. When skilled martial artists face off, it's very different from choreographed Hollywood fight scenes. High-level practitioners rarely overextend, and they know how to read incoming attacks. Large, fancy movements like cinematic spinning back kicks usually don't work. They're too telegraphed and take too long to reach the target. A boxing jab is much more effective because it covers little distance, it's quick, and it's fundamentally sound. A critical challenge for all practical martial artists is to make their diverse techniques take on the efficiency of the jab. When I watched William Chen spar, he was incredibly understated and exuded shocking power. While some are content to call such abilities chi and stand in awe, I wanted to understand what was going on. The next phase of my martial growth would involve turning the large into the small. My understanding of this process, in the spirit of my numbers to leave numbers method of chess study, is to touch the essence, for example, highly refined and deeply internalized body mechanics or feeling of a technique, and then to incrementally condense the external manifestation of the technique while keeping true to its essence. Over time, expansiveness decreases while potency increases. I call this method making smaller circles. Let's combine Persig's brick with my concept of making smaller circles and see how they work. Let's say that I'm cultivating a certain martial technique. For a simple example, a classic straight punch. I stand with my left leg forward, my hands up by my head to protect my face. The jab is a short punch coming from the left forward hand. The straight is the power punch coming from the ground, generating through my left foot and moving through my left leg, torso, diagonally across and up to the right side of my back, through the shoulder, tricep, and finally delivered by the second and third knuckles of my right hand. First, I practice the motion over and over in slow motion. We have to be able to do something slowly before we can have any hope of doing it correctly with speed. I release my left hip, wind up, and spring the right hand into motion as my left foot and hip joint spin my waist and upper body into action. Initially, I'll have tension in my shoulder or back, but then I'll soothe it away, slowly repeating the movement until the correct body mechanics are in my skin. Over time, I'm not thinking about the path from foot to fist. I'm just feeling the ground connecting to my fingertips, as if my body is a conduit for the electrical impulse of a punch. Then I start speeding things up, winding up and delivering over and over. Eventually, I start using a heavy bag, practicing these body mechanics with increasing power, building resistance in my body so I can deliver more and more force without hurting myself. My coiling gets stronger, and sometimes I hit the bag with a surprising pop, a dangerous moment. When hitting something instead of moving through empty space, I might start to get excited and throw my shoulder into the punch. This is a classic error. It breaks my structure and destroys the connection from foot to fingertip. Many boxers make this mistake, and come away with shoulder injuries. I want to punch without punching. No intention. My teacher, William Chen, sometimes teaches punching by telling students to pour a cup of tea. It's a beautiful thing. Pouring tea creates the perfect punch because people's minds don't get in the way. Okay, so now weeks and months, maybe years, pass with the cultivation of the right straight punch. I know how to wind up properly. When I hit the bag, nothing hurts. There are no breaks in my structure. It feels as if the ground is smashing the bag through my fist, and my body mechanics are smooth and relaxed. I've also built up quite a bit of power from all the work with winding up, coiling, and releasing the body into motion. When throwing my right, I don't think about anything technical anymore. My body just knows the right feeling and does it. No mind. It's in the blood. I've learned how to throw a straight right, but not really. The thing is, unless they're flustered or caught in an awkward moment, a good fighter is rarely going to get caught with a big old long wound-up straight punch. It's just too obvious. This is where making smaller circles comes into play. By now, the body mechanics of the punch have been condensed in my mind to a feeling. I don't need to hear or see any effect. My body knows when it's operating correctly by an internal sense of harmony. A parallel would be a trained singer who, through years of practice, knows what the notes feel like vibrating inside. Then she's giving a concert in a big venue, and the sound system is a nightmare. From onstage, she can't hear herself at all, a surprisingly common occurrence. The great performer can deliver a virtuoso performance without hearing a thing, because she knows how the notes should feel coming out, even if her primary monitor, her ears, are temporarily unavailable. So, I know what a properly delivered straight right feels like. Now I begin to slowly, incrementally condense my movements while maintaining that feeling. Instead of a big wind-up in the hips, I coil a little less, and then I release the punch. While initially I may have thrown my straight from next to my ear, now I gradually inch my hand out, starting the punch from closer and closer to the target, and I don't lose power. The key is to take small steps so the body can barely feel the condensing practice. Each little refinement is monitored by the feeling of the punch, which I gained from months or years of training with the large, traditional motion. Slowly but surely, my body mechanics get more and more potent. My waist needs little movement to generate speed. My hand can barely move and still deliver a powerful blow. Eventually, I can deliver a straight punch that looks nothing like a straight punch. If you've ever watched some of the most explosive hitters in the boxing world, for instance, Mike Tyson or Muhammad Ali, you've seen fights where knockouts look completely unrealistic. Sometimes you have to watch in slow motion, over and over, to see any punch at all. They've condensed large circles into very small ones, and made their skills virtually invisible to the untrained eye. The Chessic manifestations of this phenomenon are quite interesting. For example, arguably the most fundamental chess principle is central control. At all levels of play, the competitor who dominates the middle of the chessboard will usually have an advantage because from this placement, his or her pieces can influence the entire battle. Curiously, if you study the games of some very strong grandmasters, they seem to completely disregard this principle. The British star, Michael Adams, might be the clearest case in point. His pieces are often on the flanks, and he appears to casually give opponents central dominance, and yet he wins. The secret behind this style of play is a profound internalization of the principles behind central domination. Michael Adams knows how to control the center without appearing to have anything to do with the center. He has made the circle so small, even grandmasters cannot see them. This concept of making smaller circles has been a critical component of my learning process in chess and the martial arts. In both fields, players tend to get attached to fancy techniques and fail to recognize that subtle internalization and refinement is much more important than the quantity of what is learned. I think it was this understanding that won me my first Pushhands National Championship in November of 2000, after just 2 years of Tai Chi study. Surely, many of my opponents knew more about Tai Chi than I did, but I was very good at what I did know. I had condensed my body mechanics into a potent state, while most of my opponents had large, elegant, and relatively impractical repertoires. The fact is that when there is intense competition, those who succeed have slightly more honed skills than the rest. It's rarely a mysterious technique that drives us to the top, but rather a profound mastery of what may well be a basic skill set. Depth beats breadth any day of the week, because it opens a channel for the intangible, unconscious, creative components of our hidden potential. Chapter 12. Using Adversity. Super Heavyweight Finals. Wang Fei-Hung All Kung Fu Championships. September 2001. A 230-pound giant glowered and raised his wrist to mine. His heavy, sweating face smelled of rage. This guy was an accomplished fighter, with a mean streak, and lots of friends at the tournament. He wanted to tear me apart. The referee stood frozen, poised to set us loose for round two. I took a deep breath, exhaled, and felt the blood pumping through my body, the ground soft beneath my feet. In 7 weeks, I would defend my title as Tai Chi Chuan Pushan's middleweight U.S. champion, and at 170 pounds, I'd entered the super heavyweight division of a regional tournament for the extra training. Maybe it was bad timing for an experiment, but I was curious to see how I could do against men much bigger and stronger than myself. In the first round, I had neutralized the big man's strength, used it against him. Now I had him mad, aggressive, and off balance. The ref gave the signal, and my opponent exploded into me, a brutal attack coming fast from all angles, but somehow in slow motion when I relaxed into the moment. In Tai Chi, the artist learns to turn aggression back onto itself, but this is easier said than done when the incoming violence is honed by decades of martial training. My shoulder slipped back when his left hand flew forward. His fist filled the empty space, but then his right hand surged toward my stomach. I melted away before the force connected, caught his right elbow, and followed the momentum. Next thing I knew, the guy was flying away from me, spinning twice in the air before righting himself 8 feet away. He shook his head and came back at me. Only a minute to go, and I will have won the finals. He attacked, and I slipped aside, sensed I had him off balance. But then his shoulder ripped into me, and I heard a crack. My hand felt icy hot. I knew it was broken. The pain jolted me into a deeper focus. Time slowed to a near stop. I didn't show him the injury, quietly fought with one arm, fell into rhythm with his attacks. On the video, his hands looked like bullets, but in the match they felt like clouds, gently rolling toward me, easily dodged, neutralized, pulled into overextension, exploited. No thought, just presence, pure flow, like a chess game. When I think of this testing moment in my martial arts career, it reminds me of that afternoon in India some years earlier when an earthquake spurred me to revelation. In both cases, distraction was converted into fuel for high performance. In the chess scene, the shaking jolted my mind into clarity, and I discovered the critical solution to the position. In the push hands moment, my broken hand made time slow down in my mind, and I was able to reach the most heightened state of awareness of my life. In the chapter The Soft Zone, I mentioned that there are three critical steps in a resilient performer's evolving relationship to chaotic situations. First, we have to learn to be at peace with imperfection. I mentioned the image of a blade of grass bending to hurricane force winds, in contrast to a brittle twig snapping under pressure. Next, in our performance training, we learn to use that imperfection to our advantage, for example, thinking to the beat of the music, or using a shaking world as a catalyst for insight. The third step of this process, as it pertains to performance psychology, is to learn to create ripples in our consciousness, little jolts to spur us along, so we're constantly inspired whether or not external conditions are inspiring. If it initially took an earthquake or broken hand for me to gain clarity, I want to use that experience as a new baseline for my everyday capabilities. In other words, now that I've seen what real focus is all about, I want to get there all the time, but I don't want to have to break a bone whenever I want my mind to kick into its full potential. So a deep mastery of performance psychology involves the internal creation of inspiring conditions. I'll lay out my methodology for systematically cultivating this ability in part 3. In this chapter, I will take these three steps of high-performance training and illustrate how they're also critical components of the long-term learning process. Let's return to that intense scene in which my broken hand inspired a moment of martial clarity. My perception became so heightened that I saw everything in slow motion. My opponent seemed stuck in molasses, while I could move at full speed. The experience was very inspiring, and ended up being a beacon for my martial arts training for years to come. However, I faced an immediate problem once the adrenaline faded. I was left with a broken hand 7 weeks before the national championships. I went to the doctor the day after the injury, hoping for some good news. But after x-rays, he told me that there was no chance I could compete. I had a spiral fracture in the fourth metacarpal. Best case scenario, he said, my bone would be fully healed in 6 weeks, but my arm would have atrophied substantially because I would be completely immobilized from the elbow down. I would have just a few days for physical therapy, and it was absurd to consider taking tournament-level impact under those conditions. I walked out of his office resolved to compete, and the day after I got my cast on, I was back in training. My first few days working with one hand, I felt a bit vulnerable. I was worried about someone accidentally knocking into my cast and jolting the injury. I held my right hand behind me, and mostly did sensitivity work with training partners I trusted. We moved slowly, standing up, without throws, doing classical push-hands in which the two players try to feel each other's centers, neutralize attacks, and subtly unbalance the partner. This isn't ego clashing or direct martial work, but an important method of heightening sensitivity to incoming power and intention, something akin to cooperative martial meditation. It's very important for athletes to do this kind of visualization work in a form appropriate to their discipline, but often when we're caught up in the intense routine of training and competition, it feels like we have no time for the internal stuff. I know this quite well. Sometimes when I'm in the heat of tournament preparation, months will pass with brutal sparring, constant pain, hitting the mats hundreds of times a night while drilling throws, and then I'll realize that I've moved a bit away from what really makes things tick. Then I'll spend a week doing soft, quiet work on timing, perception, reading and controlling my opponent's breath patterns and internal blinks, subtle unbalancing touches that set up the dramatic throws that ultimately steal the spotlight. After these periods of reflection, I'll almost invariably have a leap in ability because my new physical skills are supercharged by becoming integrated into my mental framework. The importance of undulating between external and internal, or concrete and abstract, technical and intuitive, training applies to all disciplines, and unfortunately the internal tends to be neglected. Most intelligent NFL players, for example, use the off-season to look at their schemes more abstractly, study tapes, break down aerial views of the field, notice offensive and defensive patterns. Then, during the season, they sometimes fall into tunnel vision, because the routine of constant pain requires every last bit of reserves. I've heard quite a few NFL quarterbacks who've had minor injuries and were forced to sit out a game or two speak of the injury as a valuable opportunity to concentrate on the mental side of their games. When they return, they play at a higher level. In all athletic disciplines, it's the internal work that makes the physical mat time click, but it's easy to lose touch with this reality in the middle of the grind. Since I had broken my right hand, I was forced to cultivate my weaker side. I quickly realized that there were certain martial movements that I relied on my strong hand to cover, and now my left had to catch up so it could do everything. Day by day, my left learned new skills, from deflecting attacks to uprooting someone at unusual angles to eating with chopsticks. After a couple weeks of slow work, my fractured right hand was a bit more stable. I was used to protecting it behind me while playing with my left, and I was also comfortable falling and rolling without touching the injury to the floor, so I was able to mix it up a bit more. Then my teacher began pairing me up with slightly more aggressive training partners who were less skilled than me and not necessarily controlled. A couple of these guys really wanted to prove something. I was a big fish at the school, and now was their moment to dominate me. They had two hands, I had one, and they intended to exploit the advantage. Clearly, I had to approach these situations with openness to being tossed around. If I wasn't prepared to invest in loss, there would be no way to do this work. That said, it was fascinating to see how my body reacted. My left arm instinctively became like two arms, with my elbow neutralizing my opponent's right hand, and my hand controlling his left arm. I had no idea the body could work this way, and after a few days of this training, the notion that I was playing at a disadvantage faded. I felt completely comfortable with one hand against two, so long as I was a bit more skilled than my partner. This new perspective opened a whole new vision of martial intercourse. I realized that whenever I could control two of his limbs with one of mine, I could easily use my unoccupied arm for free pickings. Today, techniques around this idea are a staple in my competitive martial style. If even for a blink of an eye you can control two of the other guy's limbs with one of yours, either with angle or timing or some sort of clinch, then the opponent is in grave danger. The free hand can take him apart. This principle applies to nearly all contact sports: basketball, football, soccer, wrestling, hockey, boxing, you name it. On the chessboard, it's also relevant. Any moment that one piece can control, inhibit, or tie down two or more pieces, a potentially critical imbalance is created on the rest of the board. On a deeper level, this principle can be applied psychologically whenever opposing forces clash. Whether speaking of a corporate negotiation, a legal battle, or even war itself, if the opponent is temporarily tied down, qualitatively or energetically more than you're expending to tie it down, you have a large advantage. The key is to master the technical skills appropriate for applying this idea to your area of focus. I was familiar with this competitive principle from my chess days, but it wasn't until I was forced to train one-handed that I began to understand how potently it could be applied to the martial arts. I would never have guessed that I could control two hands with one in a freestyle exchange. But to be honest, after 3 or 4 weeks I became so comfortable fending off both my opponent's hands with my left that the idea of ultimately getting my right hand back felt like an unfair luxury. This injury was becoming a tremendous source of inspiration. There was also an intriguing physical component of my recovery. I wanted to compete in the nationals, so bizarre though it may sound, I resolved not to atrophy. At this point in my life, I was very involved in the subtle internal dynamics of the body through Tai Chi meditation. I had an idea that I might be able to keep my right side strong by intense visualization practice. My method was as follows. I did a daily resistance workout routine on my left side, and after every set, I visualized the workout passing to the muscles on the right. My arm was in a cast, so there was no actual motion possible, but I could feel the energy flowing into the unused muscles. I admit it was a shot in the dark, but it worked. My whole body felt strong, and when the doctor finally took off my cast, he was stunned. 4 days before the nationals, an x-ray showed that my bone was fully healed, and I had hardly atrophied at all. The doctor cleared me to compete. On Wednesday, I did my first weight workout on my right side in 7 weeks. On Friday, I flew to San Diego. And on Saturday, slightly favoring my newly empowered left arm, I won the nationals. One thing I've learned as a competitor is that there are clear distinctions between what it takes to be decent, what it takes to be good, what it takes to be great, and what it takes to be among the best. If your goal is to be mediocre, then you have a considerable margin for error. You can get depressed when fired and mope around waiting for someone to call with a new job offer. If you hurt your toe, you can take 6 weeks watching television and eating potato chips. In line with that mindset, most people think of injuries as setbacks, something they have to recover from or deal with. From the outside, for fans or spectators, an injured athlete is in purgatory, hovering in an impotent state between competing and sitting on the bench. In my martial arts life, every time I tweak my body, well-intended people like my mother suggest I take a few weeks off training. What they don't realize is that if I were to stop training whenever something hurt, I would spend my whole year on the couch. Almost without exception, I'm back on the mats the next day, figuring out how to use my new situation to heighten elements of my game. If I want to be the best, I have to take risks others would avoid, always optimizing the learning potential of the moment, and turning adversity to my advantage. That said, there are times when the body needs to heal, but those are ripe opportunities to deepen the mental, technical, internal side of my game. When aiming for the top, your path requires an engaged, searching mind. You have to make obstacles spur you to creative new angles in the learning process. Let setbacks deepen your resolve. You should always come off an injury or a loss better than when you went down. Another angle on this issue is the unfortunate correlation for some between consistency and monotony. It's all too easy to get caught up in the routines of our lives and to lose creativity in the learning process. Even people who are completely devoted to cultivating a certain discipline often fall into a mental rut, a disengaged lifestyle that implies excellence can be obtained by going through the motions. We lose presence. Then an injury or some other kind of setback throws a wrench in the gears. We are forced to get imaginative. Ultimately, we should learn how to use the lessons from this type of experience without needing to get injured. A basketball player should play lefty for a few months to even out his game. A soccer player who favors his right leg should not take a right-footed shot for an extended period of time. If dirty opponents inspire a great competitor to raise his game, he should learn to raise his game without relying on the ugly ruses of his opponents. I'll discuss this idea more deeply in Making Sandals in Part 3. Once we learn how to use adversity to our advantage, we can manufacture the helpful growth opportunity without actual danger or injury. I call this tool the internal solution. We can notice external events that trigger helpful growth or performance opportunities, and then internalize the effects of those events without their actually happening. In this way, adversity becomes a tremendous source of creative inspiration. Chapter 13. Slowing Down Time. As a child, I had a fear that I could never be a chess master, because I wouldn't be able to fit all the information into my mind. Sometimes after 2 hours of a chess lesson, my teacher's words seemed to go in one ear and out the other, and I envisioned a brain filled to the brim. Where could I ever put so much more? And if I did manage to cram everything in there, how would I be able to sort through the stuff? Of course, this type of childhood fear is a little silly. Skilled humans internalize large amounts of data. But I was onto something. Once we reach a certain level of expertise at a given discipline, and our knowledge is expansive, the critical issue becomes, how is all this stuff navigated and put to use? I believe the answers to this question are the gateway to the most esoteric levels of elite performance. Thinking back on the chapter Making Smaller Circles, it's apparent that I was focusing on the subtle, introspective cultivation of external skills. Now let's turn further inward and explore what states of heightened perception can be cultivated with proper training. When I broke my hand in that super heavyweight finals match, time slowed down in my mind. Or my perception became so sharpened, so focused on the essential, that I processed necessary information much more quickly than usual. I didn't feel like I was racing, however. Internally, the experience was profoundly calm, with a razor's edge. The epitome of what I think quality presence should be all about. Once my hand healed and the nationals were over, the question on my mind was, how can I make time slow down without breaking a limb? Everyone has heard stories of women lifting cars off their children, or of time seeming to slow down during a car accident or fall down the stairs. Clearly, there's a survival mechanism that allows human beings to channel their physical and mental capacities to an astonishing degree of intensity in life or death moments. But can we do this at will? When I started thinking about how I could consistently make my perception of time be different from my opponents, I realized that I had to delve into the operating mechanism of intuition. I suspect we have all had the experience of being stumped by something, eventually moving on to something else, and then suddenly knowing the answer to the initial problem. Most of us have also had the experience of meeting someone and having a powerfully good or bad feeling about them, without knowing why. I have found that even if a few times it has taken years to pan out, these guiding instincts have been on the money. Along the same lines, in my chess days, nearly all my revelatory moments emerge from the unconscious. My numbers to leave numbers approach to chess study was my way of having a working relationship with the unconscious parts of my mind. I would take in vast amounts of technical information that my brain somehow put together into bursts of insight that felt more like music or wind than mathematical combinations. Increasingly, I had the sense that the key to these leaps was interconnectedness. Some part of my being was harmonizing all my relevant knowledge, making it gel into one potent eruption. And suddenly the enigmatic was crystal clear. But what was really happening? The question of intuition is hotly debated among psychologists, philosophers, and artists, and it's been a source of much research and thought in my life. My grandmother, Stella Waitzkin, a boldly creative abstract expressionist painter and sculptor, used to tell me that intuition was the hand of God. Artists often refer to intuition as a muse. In the introduction, I mentioned that one philosophy professor of mine at Columbia University told me rather proudly that the very notion of intuition is incoherent. It doesn't exist. In my opinion, intuition is our most valuable compass in this world. It's the bridge between the unconscious and the conscious mind, and it is hugely important to keep in touch with what makes it tick. If we get so caught up in narcissistic academic literalism that we dismiss intuition as non-existent because we don't fully understand it, or if we blithely consider the unconscious to be a piece of machinery that operates mystically in a realm that we have no connection to, then we lose the rich opportunity to have open communication with the wellspring of our creativity. For much of this book, I've described my vision of the road to mastery. You start with the fundamentals, get a solid foundation fueled by understanding the principles of your discipline. Then you expand and refine your repertoire, guided by your individual predispositions, while keeping in touch, however abstractly, with what you feel to be the essential core of the art. What results is a network of deeply internalized, interconnected knowledge that expands from a central, personal locus point. The question of intuition relates to how that network is navigated and used as fuel for creative insight. Let's begin the plunge into this issue with chess serving as a metaphor for all disciplines. The clearest way to approach this discussion is with the imagery of chunking and carved neural pathways. Chunking relates to the mind's ability to assimilate large amounts of information into a cluster that is bound together by certain patterns or principles particular to a given discipline. The initial studies on this topic were, conveniently, performed on chess players, who were considered to be the clearest example of sophisticated unconscious pattern integration. The Dutch psychologist Adriaan de Groot, in 1965, and years later the team of William Simon and Herbert Chase, in 1973, put chess players of varying skill levels in front of chess positions and then asked them to recreate those positions on an adjacent empty board. The psychologists taped and studied the eye patterns and timings of the players while they performed the tasks. The relevant conclusions were that stronger players had better memories when the positions were taken out of games of other strong players, because they recreated the positions by taking parts of the board, say 5 or 6 pieces, and chunking, merging, them in the mind, by their interrelationships. The stronger the player, the more sophisticated was his or her ability to quickly discover connecting logical patterns between the pieces, attack, defense, tension, pawn chains, etc., and thus they had better chess memories. On the other hand, when presented with random chess positions, with no logical cohesiveness, the memories of the players seemed to level off. In some cases, the weaker players performed more effectively, because they were accustomed to random situations, while the stronger players were a bit lost, without logic to the position. So, in a nutshell, chunking relates to the mind's ability to take lots of information, find a harmonizing, logically consistent strain, and put it together into one mental file that can be accessed as if it were a single piece of information. By carved neural pathways, I'm referring to the process of creating chunks and the navigation system between chunks. I am not making a literal physical description, so much as illustrating the way the brain operates. Let's say that I spend 15 years studying chess. During these thousands of hours, my mind is effectively cutting paths through the dense jungle of chess. The jungle analogy is a good one. Imagine how time-consuming it would be to use a machete to cut your way through thick foliage. A few miles could take days. Once the path is cleared, however, you could move quickly through the clearing. If you were to make a road and ride a bike or other vehicle, the transportation would get faster still. When confronted by a new chess position, initially I have to plod through the variations. During this process, I discover organizing principles and new patterns of movement. This new information gets systematized into a network of chunks that I can access with increasing ease as my navigational function improves. Now, let's turn to the learning of chess and see how these functions really operate. We will start with day one. The first thing I have to do is to internalize how the pieces move. I have to learn their values. I have to learn how to coordinate them with one another. Early on, these steps might seem complex. There is the pawn, the knight, the bishop, the rook, the queen, and the king. Each piece is unique, with its own strengths and weaknesses. Each time I look at a chess piece, I have to remember what it is and how it moves. Then I look at the next piece and try to remember how that one moves. There are initially 32 pieces on a chessboard. To make a responsible chess decision, I have to look at all those pieces and check for captures, quick attacks, and other obvious possibilities. By the time I get to the third piece, I'm already a bit overwhelmed. By the 10th piece, I have a headache, I've already forgotten what I discovered about the first 9 pieces, and my opponent is bored. At this point, I will probably just make a move and blunder. So let's say that now, instead of launching from the standard starting position, we begin on an empty board with just a king and a pawn against a king. These are relatively simple pieces. I learn how they both move, and then I play around with them for a while until I feel comfortable. Then, over time, I learn about bishops in isolation, then knights, rooks, and queens. Soon enough, the movements and values of the chess pieces are natural to me. I don't have to think about them consciously, but see their potential simultaneously with the figurine itself. Chess pieces stop being hunks of wood or plastic and begin to take on an energetic dimension. Where the piece currently sits on a chessboard pales in comparison to the countless vectors of potential flying off in my mind. I see how each piece affects those around it. Because the basic movements are natural to me, I can take in more information and have a broader perspective of the board. Now when I look at a chess position, I can see all the pieces at once. The network is coming together. Next, I have to learn the principles of coordinating the pieces. I learn how to place my arsenal most efficiently on the chessboard, and I learn to read the road signs that determine how to maximize a given soldier's effectiveness in a particular setting. These road signs are principles. Just as I initially had to think about each chess piece individually, now I have to plod through the principles in my brain to figure out which apply to the current position and how. Over time, that process becomes increasingly natural to me, until I eventually see the pieces and the appropriate principles in a blink. While an intermediate player will learn how a bishop's strength in the middle game depends on the central pawn structure, a slightly more advanced player will just flash his or her mind across the board and take in the bishop and the critical structural components. The structure and the bishop are one. Neither has any intrinsic value outside of its relation to the other, and they are chunked together in the mind. This new integration of knowledge has a peculiar effect, because I begin to realize that the initial maxims of peace value are far from ironclad. The pieces gradually lose absolute identity. I learn that rooks and bishops work more efficiently together than rooks and knights, but queens and knights tend to have an edge over queens and bishops. Each piece's power is purely relational, depending on such variables as pawn structure and surrounding forces. So now when you look at a knight, you see its potential in the context of the bishop a few squares away. Over time, each chess principle loses rigidity, and you get better and better at reading the subtle signs of qualitative relativity. Soon enough, learning becomes unlearning. The stronger chess player is often the one who is less attached to a dogmatic interpretation of the principles. This leads to a whole new layer of principles, those that consist of the exceptions to the initial principles. Of course, the next step is for those counterintuitive signs to become internalized, just as the initial movements of the pieces were. The network of my chess knowledge now involves principles, patterns, and chunks of information, accessed through a whole new set of navigational principles, patterns, and chunks of information, which are soon followed by another set of principles and chunks designed to assist in the interpretation of the last. Learning chess at this level becomes sitting with paradox, being at peace with and navigating the tension of competing truths, letting go of any notion of solidity. This is where things get interesting. We are at the moment when psychology begins to transcend technique. Everyone at a high level has a huge amount of chess understanding, and much of what separates the great from the very good is deep presence, relaxation of the conscious mind, which allows the unconscious to flow unhindered. This is a nuanced and largely misunderstood state of mind that, when refined, involves a subtle reintegration of the conscious mind into a free-flowing unconscious process. The idea is to shift the primary role from the conscious to the unconscious without blissing out and losing the precision the conscious can provide. For a physical analogy, consider your vision. Let's allow the conscious mind to be represented by your area of visual focus, and your unconscious to be your peripheral vision. Let's say you are sitting down, reading a book. What you see is the book. Now, if you relax your eyes and allow your peripheral vision to take over, your visual awareness will take in much more. You can see things that are well off to the side. Now, the next step is to refocus on the book, while maintaining a peripheral awareness. This is a skill that some martial artists cultivate for situations with multiple opponents, or other such unpredictable occasions. In a relaxed enough state of mind, you can zoom in on something in front of you with great precision, while maintaining a very sharp awareness of your surroundings. Along these lines, chess players must let the unconscious flow, while the conscious leads and follows, sorting out details, putting things in order, making precise mathematical calculations. Most people would be surprised to discover that if you compare the thought process of a grandmaster to that of an expert, much weaker but quite competent chess player, you will often find that the grandmaster consciously looks at less, not more. That said, the chunks of information that have been put together in his mind allow him to see much more with much less conscious thought. So he is looking at very little and seeing quite a lot. This is the critical idea. A technical example of how this might function in chess is for a player to consider a pair of opposing bishops on a semi-open chessboard. There is a huge amount of information which is fundamental to deciphering the dynamics of those two bishops. That is, central pawn structure, surrounding pieces, potential trades, possible transitions to closed or open games or to endgames of varying pawn structures, initiative, king safety, principles of interpreting these principles of interpreting those interpretive principles, and so on. For the grandmaster, the list is very long. For the expert, it is relatively short. But more importantly, the grandmaster has a much more highly evolved navigational system, so he can sort through his expansive network of bishop-related knowledge in a flash. He sees bishop and immediately processes all related information, while the expert has to labor through a much smaller amount of data with much more effort. The grandmaster looks at less and sees more because his unconscious skill set is much more highly evolved. Now think of me, Josh, competing against a less refined martial artist. Let's say I'm in the process of instigating a throw. that involves 6 technical steps. My opponent will experience an indecipherable flurry of action, while for me, the 6 external steps of the throw are just the outer rim of a huge network of chunks. Our realities are very different. I am seeing much more than he is seeing. Consider one of my favorite judo techniques, a variation of a sacrifice throw, or sutemi waza. I am facing my opponent. My left hand holds his right wrist, or sleeve, and my right hand holds his collar. The technique involves the following steps. 1. I gently push forward with my right hand on his chest, causing a reactive push back. Following the momentum of his push. 2. I simultaneously pull his right arm forward and across his body, slip my left foot in front of his right foot, pull down with my right hand on his lapel, and sit back while spinning a bit to my left. 3. His right foot is blocked, so he has to fall forward, which actually feels okay to him because he'll apparently land on top of me. As he starts to fall forward, however, my right foot slips between his legs. 4. As he falls on top of me, I pull his right arm in toward me and kick up against his left inner thigh with my right foot, flipping him over. 5. I roll, following his fall, and end up on top of him. 6. In the transition at the end of this technique, I take his head in what is known as a scarf hold and trap his right arm in a submission lock. The first time someone has this rather counterintuitive throw done to them, it will all be a blur, one fast, vertiginous experience of being flipped onto the floor and landed on. I speak from experience. I first saw the throw when my close friend Ahmed sprung it on me in training a few years ago. Ahmed is a 6'2", 200-pound powerhouse, whose martial instincts emerged from a very different place than mine. He is a near-Olympic-caliber sprinter, professional dancer and musician, and a lifetime martial artist, which involves an undefeated Muay Thai full-contact kickboxing record, 15-0, and tremendous Jeet Kune Do and karate training. I was pretty skilled in Tai Chi Chuan, had recently won bronze in the World Championships, had some judo experience, and at this time Ahmed and I were both a little over a year into our study of the grappling art Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with the mind-blowing martial artist and teacher John Machado. Because of our different backgrounds, training with Ahmed often led to creative eruptions. When such knowledge gaps exist, much of the battle involves surviving the unexpected and bringing the game into a place where the neural pathways are carved. Other times, it's like running a gauntlet. When the transition from the familiar to the foreign takes place, it feels like the mind is flying downhill over fresh snow and suddenly hits a patch of thick mud. As an obvious rule, it's good to be the one flying downhill while your opponent is in the mud. Ahmed and I were in the swirl of free training, moving fast. I was on my feet, then I was head over heels and on my back before my brain knew what to make of the situation. I hadn't been blindsided like this in quite some time. I immediately asked Ahmed to break down the throw for me, and soon enough I saw that the blur involved 5 or 6 steps, the foundation of which was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu sweep I had not really understood. I decided that this was a throw I wanted to cultivate at a very high level. I figured that if it could catch me, it would catch other people. So I started practicing. First, I worked on each step slowly, over and over, refining my timing and precision. Then I put the whole thing together, repeating the movements hundreds, eventually thousands of times. Today, this throw is my bread and butter. In time, each step of the technique is expanded in my mind in more and more detail. The slightest variations in the way my opponent responds to my first push will lead to numerous options in the way I will trigger into the throw. My pull on his right wrist will involve 20 or 30 subtle details with which I will vary my action based on his nuanced micro-responses. As I sit back on the ground and trip his right foot, my perception of the moment might involve 30 or 40 variations. Recall that initially I experienced the whole throw as a blur, too fast to decipher, and now we're talking about a tiny portion of the throw, involving many distinct moments. When it felt like a blur, my conscious mind was trying to make sense of unfamiliar terrain. Now my unconscious navigates a huge network of subtly programmed technical information, and my conscious mind is free to focus on certain essential details that, because of their simplicity, I can see with tremendous precision, as if the blink in my opponent's eyes takes many seconds. The key to this process is understanding that the conscious mind, for all its magnificence, can only take in and work with a certain limited amount of information in a unit of time. Envision that capacity as one page on your computer screen. If it's presented with a large amount of information, then the font will have to be very small in order to fit it all on the page. You will not be able to see the details of the letters. But if that same tool, the conscious mind, is used for a much smaller amount of information in the same amount of time, then we can see every detail of each letter. Now time feels slowed down. Another way of understanding this difference in perception is with the analogy of a camera. With practice, I'm making networks of chunks and paving more and more neural pathways, which effectively takes huge piles of data and throws it over to my high-speed processor, the unconscious. Now my conscious mind, focusing on less, seems to rev up its shutter speed from, say, 4 frames per second to 300 or 400 frames per second. The key is to understand that my trained mind is not necessarily working much faster than an untrained mind. It's simply working more effectively, which means that my conscious mind has less to deal with. Experientially, because I'm looking at less, there are within the same unit of time hundreds of frames in my mind, and maybe only a few for my opponent, whose conscious mind is bogged down with much more data that has not yet been internalized as unconsciously accessible. I can now operate in all those frames that he doesn't even see. This is why profoundly refined martial artists can sometimes appear mystical to less skilled practitioners. They have trained themselves to perceive and operate within segments of time that are too small to be perceived by untrained minds. Now, returning to the scene that initially inspired this movement of thought in my life. Does this type of trained enhanced perception I've been discussing come from the same place as those wild moments in life when time slows down in the middle of a car crash, or in my case, when my hand shattered in the ring? The answer is yes and no. The similarity is that a life or death scenario kicks the human mind into a very narrow area of focus. Time feels slowed down because we instinctively zero in on a tiny amount of critical information that our processor can then break down as if it is in a huge font. The trained version of this state of mind shares that tiny area of conscious focus. The difference is that in our disciplines of choice, we cultivate this experience by converting all the other surrounding information into unconsciously integrated data instead of ignoring it. There is a reason the human mind rarely goes into that wild place of heightened perception. If an untrained fighter were to focus all his energy on his opponent's breath pattern or blinking eye, he would get punched in the face or thrown on the ground. If whenever I crossed New York's 33rd Street and 6th Avenue, I zoned in on some random car that wasn't about to hit me and I saw it passing in slow motion, then there's a good chance that one of these days I'd get hit by another car. In most situations, we need to be aware of what is happening around us, and our processor is built to handle this responsibility. On the other hand, armed with an understanding of how intuition operates, we can train ourselves to have remarkably potent perceptual and physical abilities in our disciplines of focus. The key, of course, is practice. Chapter 14. The Illusion of the Mystical. Early on in my study of the philosophical foundation of Tai Chi, while scouring through a book of old adages called the Tai Chi Classics, I came upon a passage that intrigued me. In the 18th century, Wang Songyue described his practice by writing, "If the opponent's movement is quick, then quickly respond. If his movement is slow, then follow slowly." Then the 19th century sage Wu Yuxiang built upon Songyue's words with a typically abstract Chinese instructional conundrum. "If the opponent does not move, then I do not move. At the opponent's slightest move, I move first." The first stanza is rather straightforward. It's about listening, being sensitive to the adversary's slightest tremble, and sticking to him. Adherence is at the center of Tai Chi's martial applicability. Basically, those four lines are about becoming a shadow. But the last idea stumped me. A shadow is an effect, not a cause. How do you move before someone you are following? The precision of my chess days made me uncomfortable accepting this abstraction on faith. What was it all about? This question was like a Zen koan to me. I spent countless hours thinking about it, trying to wrap my head around the idea and to embody it in Pushan's training. While it's true that many of the old-school Taoist images should not be taken too literally, there is often a large kernel of experiential truth behind descriptions such as this one. I knew from chess that a superior artist can often get into the head of the opponent, mesmerize him with will or strategic mastery, using what I playfully like to call Jedi mind tricks. As far as I understood, the keys to these moments were penetrating insight into what makes the other tick and technical virtuosity that makes the discovery and exploitation invisible to the opponent. On the other hand, Chinese martial arts tend to focus more on energy than pattern recognition. My goal was to find a hybrid, energetic awareness, technical fluidity, and keen psychological perception. Chess meets Tai Chi Chuan. In time, I have come to understand those words, at the opponent's slightest move, I move first, as pertaining to intention, reading, and ultimately controlling intention. The deepest form of adherence, or shadowing, involves a switching of roles, where the follower becomes the followed, in a relationship in which time seems to twist in a tangle of minds. This is how the great Tai Chi or Aikido artist guides the opponent into a black hole, or appears to psychically impel the other to throw himself on the ground. But what is really happening? Let's build on the last few chapters and try to break it down. My experimentation with intentionality began during my early chess years. I'm a bit embarrassed to admit that as a 7-year-old boy in scholastic chess tournaments, I sometimes lured my young opponents into blundering by 1, making a move that set a trap, and then 2, immediately groaning and slapping my head. This over-the-top display would usually inspire a careless moment of overconfidence, followed by an eager capture of a poisoned pawn or some other seductive bait. Not very subtle on my part, I agree. But as with all skills, the most sophisticated techniques tend to have their foundation in the simplest of principles. As I improved as a chess player and competitor, my opponents and I developed increasingly complex understandings of psychological tells. By the time I was 10 or 11 years old, a slap on the head would have been an absurdly transparent display of trickery. But a little change in my breathing pattern might alert a rival that I had just seen something I didn't like. I don't have much of a natural poker face. I'm an outgoing guy and tend to wear my heart on my sleeve. Instead of trying to change my personality, I learned how to use it to my advantage. While some chess players spend a lot of energy maintaining a stony front, I let opponents read my facial expressions as I moved through thought processes. My goal was to use my natural personality to dictate the tone of the struggle. Just how a poker player might hum a tune to put it in the head of an opponent, thereby getting in his head, I would control the psychology of the game by unmasking myself. If I sat up high in my chair in a natural display of confidence, my opponent might wonder if I was covering something up. Was this reverse psychology? Maybe reverse-reverse psychology. Maybe reverse-reverse-reverse psychology. In addition to the moves I made on the board, I was posing another set of conundrums for an opponent to ponder. Of course, I was not so transparent. Mixed in with my genuine impressions would be misleading furrows of the brow, trickles of fear, or subtle flutters of excitement. Sometimes this type of deception would simply involve the timing of a sip of water or a flicker of my eyes. But not always. Against some rivals, I would be completely straightforward emotionally, with no attempt at pretense. This open book quality might continue from one tournament to the next. Over time, my barely perceptible tells were steadily reliable, and my opponent would trust what he was seeing. Gradually, my mood would become part of his evaluative process, like a leg a martial artist is conditioned to lean on before it swept away. When the right moment or critical game was at hand, and I was faintly misleading about my current level of confidence, I could provoke an overextension or an overly cautious decision. This was a delicate dance. At the same time, I was a careful observer of my rivals' rhythms. As I moved into my late teenage years, many of my tournaments were closed, invitational events, where 10 to 14 very strong players gathered for 2-week marathons. These were psychological wars. Imagine 14 world-class chess players living together in a small resort above a Bermuda cliff. We ate meals together, took walks on the beach, formed complicated friendships, compared notes about our approaches to the game. And every afternoon at 3 o'clock, we went to battle. This type of environment was a hotbed of psychological maneuvering. It was during these years that I began to draw the parallels between people's life tendencies and their chessic dispositions. Great players are all, by definition, very clever about what they show over the chessboard. But in life's more mundane moments, even the most cunning chess psychologists can reveal certain essential nuances of character. If, over dinner, a grandmaster tastes something bitter and faintly wrinkles his nose, there might be an inkling of a tell lurking. Impatience while standing in line at the buffet might betray a problem sitting with tension. It's amazing how much you can learn about someone when they get caught in the rain. Some will run with their hands over their heads. Others will smile and take a deep breath while enjoying the wind. What does this say about one's relationship to discomfort, the reaction to surprise, the need for control? By the time I moved into the competitive martial arts, I was very much in tune with my tells, and was quite good at manipulating opponents' impressions of my state of mind. I had also reached a fairly high level of reading psychological wrinkles. It was during these years that I began to cultivate methods of systematically controlling my opponent's intention. In chess, a huge amount of psychological observation and manipulation might ultimately manifest as a subtle hitch in an opponent's thought process. In physical disciplines like the martial arts, getting into the opponent's head has an immediate and often violent effect that is much more visible to the observing eye. Envision the following scene. I'm competing against an experienced push-hands opponent who has 50 pounds on me. He's a good athlete, fast, strong, aggressive. The idea is to stay on your feet and within the ring. In this matchup, I'm not going to win with force. It's the mental side of the game that will be critical. The match begins with our right wrists crossed. I apply light pressure on his wrist, and he pushes back. The mood is set. As the play begins, we circle one another. I probe him with feints, and each time he comes back at me with a counterattack. We go into the clinch, both of us having our right arms wrapped underneath the opponent's left armpit, both with our right legs forward. I pulse twice with my right shoulder, and each time he meets my pulse with resistance. I break out of the clinch. I'm backing up. We play a little more, at a distance. A few times I push into his midsection, and he confidently holds his ground. Then I create an opening, allowing him to close distance and pull me back into the clinch. On the entry, I pulse again with my right shoulder, this time very subtly, and immediately trigger into a throw where I empty out my right side and torque him into the hole. He hits the ground hard and is confused. What happened? This is an overstated example of mental programming. What I did here is observe and provoke a pattern of action-reaction in my opponent. He was much bigger than me, so probably entered the matchup wanting to impose his power. I began by barely pressing against his wrist in the starting position. Here he could have just neutralized my pressure, let it go. But instead he held his ground, pushed back. I have engaged his ego. He's already set up. Next I went into the clinch with the big guy and pushed twice without any ambition to move him. I just wanted to more deeply inspire our rhythm of dance. He's big, I'm small. When I push, he pushes back. If you think about what this means, in that second in which he is responding to my shoulder probe with counterforce, I am supporting some of his weight. I am becoming one of his legs. When I backed out of the clinch that first time, he felt very good. He's gaining ground. I'm unhappy. So he thinks. I continue to inspire his pushback mentality for a few more moments, and then I return to the clinch. This time my shoulder pulse is very subtle. He does not have to make a decision to push back. It just happens reflexively. But now, immediately after my pulse, and actually just before his response begins, I trigger into a throw that is entirely based on his approaching, programmed reaction. I empty out my right side, which has the effect of removing the leg he is just starting to lean on, and I add to his sliver of momentum with a condensed, potent technique. He hits the floor in a blur. Whenever these types of moments happen in the martial arts, it feels a little magical. He experiences standing and then falling into a black hole, because our final exchange was all very subtle, and perhaps invisible to his conscious mind. In actual martial play, these types of exchanges are much more refined. Imagine the condensing process of making smaller circles, applied to the observation and programming side of this interaction. What can really happen is that our wrists meet, and I apply the tiniest amount of pressure conceivable. My opponent holds his ground without his conscious mind even realizing that he's responded. He's already set up to be thrown with a 1-2 combination because his reaction to the 1 is already predictable. I will move before his 2. Taking this one step further, if my first movement is condensed enough, it will hardly manifest physically at all. My 2 appears to be a 1. At the opponent's slightest move, I move first. Consider one of the more interesting and psychologically subtle card tricks performed by highly evolved illusionists. A magician is on stage and asks an audience member to join him. When the volunteer, a genuinely unplanted middle-aged man who seems to be enjoying the show, approaches, the performer holds his attention for a few moments while he handles the cards. Then the illusionist lays the 52 cards, a real deck, on a table and asks the man to think about a card. Visualize it. The magician then shuffles the cards, lays the deck on the table, and asks the volunteer to flip the top card. It's the envisioned card. What happened here? Did the magician really read the man's mind and then miraculously separate that card from the other 51? Of course not. This particular illusion is very much in line with the controlling of intention that a martial artist might employ. The key is the subtle manipulation of the volunteer's conscious and unconscious minds. It all happens before the magic begins. As the two men stand before one another, in conversation, the illusionist engages the volunteer. This interaction is dictated by the magician. The volunteer is answering questions, following, trying to look good on stage. In the midst of all this, and in a blur that no one in the audience notices, the illusionist flashes a card. This is the sleight of hand. The critical point is that the volunteer must unconsciously notice the card without the observation registering in his conscious mind. He is engaged in the banter of the illusionist, and then suddenly has a seed planted in his mind. When asked to envision a card, that choice has already been made for him. Manipulating the card throughout the shuffle so it remains at the top of the deck is child's play for a halfway decent sleight-of-hand artist. The subtlety of this deception is that if the performer fails to fully engage the man's conscious mind, then the clever volunteer will realize he's being programmed and decide to choose another card. The trick won't work. If a pattern of interaction is recognizable to the adversary, then mental conditioning will not be terribly effective. In the push-hand scene I described above, had my opponent recognized that his ego was being manipulated, he could have thwarted my plan. My feigned unhappiness in backing up made him feel powerful, confident, so he was not on the lookout for being set up. This allowed a series of subtle conditioning exchanges, which finally erupted into a throw. If I had really shoved the guy, he surely would have recognized what I was doing. I had to operate beneath his radar. This is where making smaller circles and slowing down time come into play. When working with highly skilled and mentally tough opponents, the psychological game gets increasingly subtle. The battle becomes about reading breath patterns and blinks of the eye, playing in frames the opponent is unaware of, invisible technical manipulation that slowly creates response patterns. If I understand a series of movements more deeply, in more frames, with more detail, then I can manipulate my opponent's intention without him realizing what happened. Here is an example of how this might be done. Stand up with your feet shoulder-width apart. Put your weight in your left leg. Now, imagine someone is standing on your left side and pushes into your body and up through your left arm with a lot of force. How are you going to keep your balance? Well, you have to lift up your right leg, go with the momentum, and then replant your right foot a couple feet away and land, as if you jumped sideways. No problem. Now put all your weight in your right leg. Again, feet shoulder-width apart. If someone were to push you from your left shoulder, you'd have a much bigger problem because your right leg is stuck to the ground. A fundamental principle of maintaining balance while moving fast, for example while neutralizing a martial artist's throw or explosive push, is that your feet should never cross. Now when you go airborne, your left foot has to make the long journey past your right if you're going to have any chance of staying up. You'll be all crossed up and probably crash into the ground. This is a simple idea with huge implications. Much of the push-hands game takes place with the two players connected up top. Hands and arms are subtly probing for tension. If I push into an opponent, he will either resist my force or empty out the attacked part of his body, dodge the blow, and let the aggression pass by. In either case, there'll be a subtle shift in weight. This is a critical moment. In that blur during which someone switches weight from one foot to another, the receiving leg is momentarily stuck. It cannot move. At a high level, athletes have developed very powerful throws. If someone is slightly off balance or unable to move freely with incoming force, he will not be able to catch up before he is hurtling toward the ground. If I trigger a throw towards someone's right foot at the precise moment that his right foot is settling onto the ground, then my opponent will not be able to correct himself. His footwork will get all twisted up. This idea is far from unique to the martial arts. If a tennis player has someone leaning left and hits the ball just out of reach to the right, the opponent will appear flat-footed and paralyzed. If an NFL running back, NBA ball handler, or World Cup soccer player can get the defender to put weight in the wrong place at the wrong time, then he can blow on by and leave the guy tripping over himself. In virtually every competitive physical discipline, if you are a master of reading and manipulating footwork, then you are a force to be reckoned with. So let's build a game around the simple principle of weight redistribution. There are two intertwined components to this process. The first is condensed technique. The second is enhanced perception. Our goal is to take advantage of the moment our opponent is switching his weight from one foot to another. There are many weaknesses or tells that may be used to approach this goal: breath patterns, physical tension, inferior technical understanding, complacency, emotion, distraction, and an array of other unconscious, predictable habits can all be homed in on or combined for the desired effect. For simplicity's sake, let's focus on the eyes, specifically the blink. First of all, most people blink without knowing it, so they probably won't consider a weakness that may be exploited in competition. Even for top competitors, there is not much of a sense of danger associated with the blink. It happens so quickly, everything feels safe. But it isn't. There is a small change in awareness that accompanies the flash of eyes, and a highly skilled player can train himself to exploit it. This is where the methodology of slowing down time comes into play. If, through incremental training as described earlier in the book, your unconscious understanding of your discipline of choice has become sufficiently advanced, and you've learned how to trust your physical and intuitive intelligence to handle the technical components of your moment, then your conscious mind can zoom in on very small amounts of data, in this case, the eyes. Because our minds are so complex, if you give us a small amount of material to work with, and we do it with great intensity, then we can break it down into microscopic detail. If our conscious mind is purely focused on the eyes, they will seem to take a while to blink. We see them beginning to close, closed, starting to open, and then open again. That's all we need. So let's say I'm doing push hands with a very skilled opponent. I'm in the zone, feeling his weight, his patterns of movement, his eyes. He has certain tells. Before a blink, maybe his cheek twitches. Maybe a touch of moisture forms around his pupil. Or maybe his eyes close a tiny bit, then reopen, then blink. All this is subtle, but I'm tapped in. Both of our right legs are forward, and we're moving around the ring. In push hands, you need to hold your ground to stay in the ring. Sometimes you have to root off the rear leg, but you don't want to spend too much time with your weight shifted back, since that gives you nowhere to go. There's not much give in your structure. Skilled players have internalized this reality, but their training can be used against them. We are flowing. Then, on his blink, or just before it begins, I pulse into a 1-2 combination, left-right, into his body. My movements are very small. I don't put much force into them. Very little seems to be happening. But my right puts him into his back leg, just barely taking the weight off his front leg. When I release the pressure from my right hand, in the middle of his blink, when his presence is slightly altered, his body instinctively settles back toward his forward leg. In that instant, I trigger into a throw which combines the fact that he's moving forward, providing momentum, and for a microsecond anchoring his forward leg to the floor. If I'm good, all this can happen before he's finished blinking. He goes flying onto the ground and comes up confused. Time and again, I've used this type of strategy in competition, and afterward opponents have come over to me and implied that I did something mystical. They were standing, and then on the ground, and they didn't feel or see anything occur in between. Of course, there's nothing mystical happening, just the interplay of some interesting psychological, technical, and learning principles. I read his intention to blink, and then controlled his intention by determining when he would unconsciously place his weight into his forward leg. If I did this well, my movements, the 1-2 combination, should barely have been visible. They serve the lone purpose of manipulating weight distribution. I should point out that the specific example of using a blink is just one of many options, and it can be neutralized. When preparing for the 2004 World Championships, my main training partner was my dear friend Daniel Caulfield. Dan is a phenomenal martial artist who plays second in the world in his weight division. He's a fierce competitor, deeply perceptive, with a philosopher's soul that gives his martial style a unique resonance. During our training for the Worlds, Dan and I squared off on the mat every night with the intensity of tournament opponents. It was strange going to war with each other after so many years of friendship. We knew each other's games intimately. There were no technical secrets, so our battles were largely of the mind. In the final 3 months of preparation, we made the risky agreement to each be responsible for his own safety, which liberated us to play as we would in the championships. There was no holding back. If one of us was slightly off, he got annihilated and had to stew in his juices until the next session. If one of us detected a tell or weakness in the other, he went after it relentlessly until a defensive adjustment was made. We weren't just competing in the ring. We were honing our abilities to read and mask the subtlest signs on the fly. Dan is a brilliant guy, with tremendously explosive power and razor-sharp technique. He knew even my tiniest habits. Every exhalation was dangerous. If my presence diminished for a fraction of a second, I was on the floor. The air felt electric during these sessions. We taped our training, and every week I broke down the video. Depending on the day, one or both of us seemed to be operating in a different dimension. Time felt slowed down or sped up. A couple of times when Dan was really on, I blinked, and by the time my eyes were open, I was in midair, flying out of the ring. This was my secret. No one had ever turned it on me before. An adjustment was called for, and I got into the habit of taking a tiny step back or pulsing into Dan on my blinks, creating a little space so he couldn't fire in on me. A few times, when I was really flowing, I used Dan's awareness of my eye patterns against him, blinking to pull him into an overextension. He quickly caught on to my ruse, and our psychology continued to evolve. If both players are aware of a tell, then it will be neutralized, made ineffective, and others will have to be unearthed and exploited. The game goes on. This type of psychological warfare is at the center of nearly all high-level competitive disciplines, and I mean competitive in the loosest sense imaginable. For example, the car salesman and potential buyer are opponents. When two highly trained minds square off in any field, the players are in a fight to enter each other's heads. These exchanges feel like epic tennis rallies, in which the tilt of battle sways back and forth as one player picks up on a faint tell that may or may not exist long enough to be exploited, and the other has to feel the danger and swat the rival out of his mind before it's too late. While refined mental competitors can have extended dialogues of this nature, in my observation, most people are relatively unaware of their psychological subtleties. This makes for easy pickings for the astute rival. So beware when squaring off with a well-versed negotiator, salesman, or lawyer. Understand that the battle stretches well beyond the traditional arena. When one player is more aware of these issues than the other, conditioning is quite simple. Quarterbacks flick their eyes and send safeties flying all over the football field. Real estate moguls furrow their brow, act impatient, check their watches to lull buyers into nervous offers. A chess player observes a rhythm, then sits, lets his clock tick even though a decision has already been reached, then finally makes his move just as the opponent predictably gets up to go to the bathroom. What now? Take a minute. Go to the bathroom. Come back. Control the pace of the game. Awareness of these dynamics can make you hard to manipulate and can allow you to turn the tables on even the savviest of conditioners. To master these psychological battles, it's essential to understand their technical foundation. Contrary to the ego-enforcing descriptions of some kung fu masters, there's nothing mystical about controlling intention or entering the mind of the opponent. These are skills to be cultivated like any other, and the last few chapters have been my attempt to lay out the roadmap to their internalization.